It sounds as though we're ready to roll. Do you want to check out the system and make sure, or shall I do that? Okay. Audience members, hopefully you can hear me. This is Tamarack, and we're going to talk about the journey of awakening. And I'd like to share a couple of ideas about that before we open it to questions or talk about anything specifically. First of all, I'd like to make something clear from my perspective, and that is that awakening is not a process. We are all already awakened. We are natural beings. We have the awarenesses we need. We have the perspectives. We have the ancestral memories. And what has happened is that they've been crowded. They've been overlaid by a lot of conditioning, a lot of habits and patterns that we've picked up in order to survive in an artificial world, in a civilized world. And that has caused us to disconnect. We have a mind-heart-body disconnection, which does not allow us to be our fully engaged, fully spontaneous beings. So I really see it as us just taking off this layer of clothes that we've been given that just doesn't fit us very well, and working on becoming our naked selves again. And I'd like to start by sharing a story about what the awakening journey is all about for me. First of all, I want to stress that stories are not to be taken literally. I don't care what kind of story it is. I don't even care if it's a true story. When I tell a story, I consider it to be a metaphor. I consider it to be something that we can use as a doorway to ourselves, a doorway to our own personal experience. And this is what it's all about, because life is story and story is life. So if we can connect through story, okay, we had some interruption there. We've had technical difficulties, I understand, whatever that is. I was saying that okay, we're going to take a brief pause to correct a technical error here. All right, we're live again. I was saying that story, the typical definition for story is that it's not real, it's a story. Well, nothing is real because everything is our own perception. Everything is filtered through our own eyes, through our own sets of experiences. So if we can embrace story as life, we can see the metaphor in story, and we can all relate to each other through the common story we all share. The Aboriginal people in Australia call this the song line. We're all part of the same song, and we're born from that song, and we return back to that song. So here's a story from the Alutek people from the Aleutian Islands in Alaska. I just learned this story about a half moon ago, a couple of weeks ago, from a friend named Tony Chemnitz, who's a tracker. And he learned it from an Alutek elder who's no longer with us. Of course, he's living on in story, as we all will. This is a story about how we lost our hair. We used to be hairy creatures, and our ancestors still are, of course. The other apes in the primate family are all hairy. We are the only hairless ones. And there's a very important reason for that. And this is also a story about how our kin, the wolves, our hunting kin, came to be. They're both very directly related. And this occurred in the long ago time when we hunted. We were hunter-gatherers, and we lived in the North Country, and the caribou were our closest kin because we lived by them. We did not live for them or with them. We lived by the caribou. They were supporting us, and you'll find out why as we get into the story. Back then, our people were very good hunters, and they would hunt the biggest and the best caribou because the young men wanted to prove themselves. They wanted to be hunters that their people could feel proud of, hunters their people could rely upon to bring back the meat and the sinew and the bone and the hides and the brains, everything, the hooves, everything that was needed for clothing, for shelter, for food, of course. All the parts of the animal were used, and our people were very respectful in that regard. And however, over time, something happened. The caribou the hunters were bringing back were getting smaller and weaker and sicker, and nobody could understand why. They didn't have the thick pelts that were needed anymore for keeping our people warm in the white season. The meat was very, very unnourishing. There was no fat. There was very little sinew for making thread. And the people didn't understand what was happening. So they called a talking circle. Everybody got together. And nobody had an answer. There were only questions. They realized they had to come up with something because the elders were starving. The elders just quit eating because there wasn't enough food to go around. The young people were getting anxious, the children especially. They saw their parents feeding them and not eating themselves. They grew desperate. There was a lot of tension with our people. And we started eating things we wouldn't typically eat, just anything to fill our bellies. But there was not enough nourishment there. There weren't enough calories to keep us going. So the elders suggested that two of the guardians go and talk with the Great Mother, who lived outside of the camp, up over a hill. Nobody actually saw the Great Mother. Everybody knew the Great Mother lived, though. The Great Mother existed because the Great Mother provided for all of our needs. So the two guardians set off, and over the hill was symbolic because it was a long journey. Over the hill is some distant place where something or somebody dwells that we are just not aware of, that we can't be in touch with. So they traveled. They traveled and traveled. And they found the Great Mother, and they sat with the Great Mother. And they told her of the pain of the people. And she listened. She was a benevolent mother, and she already knew, yet she listened. And she asked the hunters why. And the hunters had nothing to say. They had no idea. They thought they were doing everything right. They were hunting respectfully. They were sharing the kill with everybody. They would not touch the animals before they got back to their people. They realized that giving was receiving. They could not figure out why the caribou were not providing for them, as because they had always laid down offerings. They had always given thanks for a successful hunt. They had always returned what little bit of the animal was not used back to the tundra so it would grow fresh reindeer moss for the caribou to eat. They had done all these things. They had feasts in honor of the caribou. They could not understand what was going wrong. So the Great Mother asked them to just sit in peace for a while, and to imagine every time they went out to pick berries, they would pull out the biggest and strongest plants. And what would happen the next berry season if they came back? What would the berries grow on? And of course, they said, well, it would grow on the smaller plants, the weaker plants. And the Great Mother then said, what if you pulled out those plants then? And you came back the next berry season, what would your berries grow on? And finally it dawned upon both of them that, yes, look what we're doing. We're taking the biggest and the strongest of the caribou, and who's left to reproduce? Who's next? Who's left to sire the calves? And who's left to nurse the calves? And how are they going to grow on poor milk? How is a sire, a poor, weak sire who's barely able to carry on, going to pass on these strong traits, these strong characteristics, in order to strengthen the herd, in order to keep the herd going? And of course, the herd was going to deteriorate. And the hunters asked the mother, what can we do? What can we do? We realize what's wrong. We know that awareness is important. We know from our healers that awareness is the first step in any change, in any healing. Now what do we do with this awareness? The mother said, I will bring you a guide. I will reach into the earth and I will pull up your brother. And your brother is Wolf. He knows how to hunt. He knows how to hunt with respect. Not just to hunt respectfully, but to hunt with respect. It is not what we do, but how we do it. Follow him. Go with him. Join his pack and do what he does. Ask no questions. Do not take part in the hunt. Just follow and shadow them. They will show you how to hunt. And the two guardians went back to their people, and they shared the story of their experience with the Great Mother. And the elders sanctioned the story. They said, yes, this was not a dream. They found the Great Mother, and this is what we must do. Let us listen to our guardians. And all of the guardians prepared for a great hunt. They knew that the pack was going to come, and they were going to be adopted into the pack. They were going to go, and they were going to go and hunt the caribou. And this came to pass the next sun. And on the hunt, the guardians were confused. They were totally confused because the wolves were going, and they were testing out the animals. They were not rushing. They were not chasing them. They were just testing them out to get them moving. And the biggest animals were there. They were there protecting the calves, and it would have been easy to kill them. It would have been easy to take them. The wolves ignored them. They just kept the animals moving, kept them nervous, and they were watching and watching. And what were they watching for, the guardians wondered. And then one wolf dashed ahead, and the caribou panicked, and they all rushed. They all ran, except for two or three behind. And you could see why. Right away, the guardian saw that, one had a broken leg. It was barely hobbling along. Another one was very old, and its shaggy hair was falling off. And there was another one, a young one, must have been born late, just not getting enough nourishment, not able to keep up with the herd. And those were the three the wolf pack jumped on and took them down very quickly and killed them because there was no resistance. And the guardians couldn't understand. Why are they taking the weak? Why are they taking the sick? Why are they taking the old? They could not understand. And they went back to their people. And they called a talking circle. And they said, this is just not going to work. Those wolves, those new brothers of ours, what kind of brothers are they? They go and they take these sick animals. And we have to find another way. Maybe we need to go back to the Great Mother and say that a mistake was made. If that could be, something is wrong. And the elder said, let us sit with this. Let us listen. Let us see the continuum of this story, the story the Great Mother gave us, which was the continuum of our story with the caribou. And then the story of the blueberries, picking the berries that the Great Mother told us. What is happening here? And gradually, one by one, the people came to see that, yes, it doesn't matter whether we are gathering willow for baskets or berries to dry for the white season, or caribou for our clothing and our sewing materials and our sinew. We take the weakest because that makes them the strongest. They are there for us so that they can keep producing. And gradually the weakest are going to get stronger, and the whole herd is going to grow and strengthen. And when we hunt with wolf and we take the weakest, the herd will gradually improve and be what it was once again. And caribou will again provide for us, and we will provide for them in a new way by taking their sick and their old, those that hold the herd back. And in this way, we are living our kinship. We are not just saying we are kin. We are not just honoring our shared spirit, our shared place here on the mother, but we are living our kinship. And this Dahō, that's the story. And there's one more part that I did not include in the telling, but that is in the losing of the hair, and maybe that is obvious here because this is part of the metaphor. The caribou were losing their hair, and when the best berry bushes are pulled out, the mother loses her hair. She loses the vegetation, the bushes that grow over her to help to protect her and to protect all of the creatures who live under the bushes, who live in her hair. And to help us to remember that we must live in honor and respect, at the time that we became kin with the wolves and started to hunt with the wolves and learn from them, we lost our hair so that we would never forget, so that we realize that the caribou need to be strong. They need to have dense, thick hair in order to help keep us warm. And now we have a symbiotic relationship with the caribou and all the similar animals, because if we take care of them, they will be strong and healthy and have thick, luxurious pelts, and they will take care of us. And this is not because of some idle philosophy or belief. It's because this is the way it has to be. And this is the way of all of our relationship with life. So this story meant a lot to me when I heard it, in part because it is a part of all the stories, all the teaching stories. They're all telling us the same thing. They all speak in different voices, using different metaphors. They're all giving us the same message of honor and respect. And this, in a big way, is what the family year-long experience was all about, and that's the basis of this teleconference here, this journey of awakening that the people who embarked in this family year-long took, was all about this reconnection, this returning to the ways of honor and respect that we only know about in theory or by belief when we live in an artificially constructed environment where we're not directly connected with the means and ends of our existence. And this is something that we learned long ago and do not have to relearn again. Because again, we are already awakened. We already know this. We already have our stories. We already have the awarenesses. We just need to brush ourselves off and take off this old clothing we have and put back on the fur of the caribou so that we have this relationship again. Here's this metaphor. It's not just the fur, of course, but it's gathering our own food again. It's bringing in our own firewood. It's taking care of ourselves first. It's taking care of each other. Not turning to institutions, not turning to any belief systems or anything like that, but honoring and embracing each other, listening to each other's truths, because each other's truths are our own truths. And herein lies our salvation. All right. Those are my introductory comments. And I would like to, I could bring up a few more things. I'd like to see if there are any questions first, though. And if there's anything you'd like to add, you might have a story of your own to share. If you have any thoughts, any questions, anything about the journey to awakening, anything about Native Lifeway, anything about the family year-long experience that this fundraiser is really all about, just anything that relates to what it is to be human, let's explore it. Is there anybody who has a question?
Hi, Tamarack. It's Tess.
Hi, Tess.
Hi.
Oh, glad to have you with us.
Yeah. My question has to do with the Native parenting and just in general how that might be different than parenting in modern society. And also, Susan mentioned a book that might go along with Native parenting. And I don't remember what it was, and I'm wondering if maybe you know what book are some good books that have to do with that subject.
Well, let's start with that. There's one book I can recommend, and it's called The Continuum Concept. The author's name escapes me right now, but you won't confuse it with any other book. I think her first name is Marlo, but if you just Google the Continuum Concept, it will come up. She's a woman who spent some time in the Amazon with a Native tribe, and she was just flabbergasted with the way they raised their children, or I should say unraised them, and we'll get into that shortly. Get the book. It's a beautiful book. It's really a story. It's not a how-to. It's a story, and the how-to is just obvious once you read the book. And when you ask your question about what raising children is all about, coming from Native perspective, what it's really all about is nothing, because Native people do not raise their children. Not in any way, shape, or form that we consider child rearing. Children have their own culture in a Native encampment. Children prepare a lot of their own food. In fact, they hunt and gather and trap a lot of their own food. They help to take care of each other. The older children are taking care of the younger children. In essence, what you see in a Native encampment is all of the children from puberty on younger are living a microcosm of the adult culture. They are emulating the adults, just like we do when we grow up. You know, we want to be like adults. Many of our toys when we are kids are miniature versions of what adults have. You know, boys are given toy tools. Boys are given cars and trucks to play with. Girls are given dolls and dollhouses and that sort of thing in our very conventional society. If you look at all of this, this is all miniature versions of the adult world. The children will play house, and Native children do the same thing. They are playing house, so to speak. They're playing games. The game of tag is, and game of hide and seek is training for the hunt. They are playing just what the adults are doing in a more serious way to help provide for the people. So what happens here is that parents are benevolent overseers, you might say. The children are there with the parents. However, they are off to their own. They oftentimes have their own hearth. And this we saw in the family year-long, where the children just gravitated toward each other, and they went off on their own. Right away, they wanted their own food pit. They wanted to start preparing and cooking their own food. They wanted to watch over things themselves. And you're probably aware of this from when you were a child or watching other children. How often does your mom or dad want to do something for you and say, no, I can do it myself, Mom, you know, and you kind of push them away? Well, this is our natural yearning to grow up, to become who we are, to become self-empowered. And in this way, we become fully actualized. In this way, we train ourselves to come to this place where we can help take care of our people someday. So there's some opening comments. Where would you like to go with this test? Is there anything in particular you'd like to explore beyond that?
Well, you know, now I'm living with someone who has a teenager, a 14-year-old now. And specifically to what's going on with me, trying to discover where my place in this unit is. And she's starting to explore something, some different things. And yeah, it's just to know how much to be involved and kind of, Nanda mentioned something that it's kind of about guiding rather than being the parent who sets strict rules for the child to follow. That's more, she mentioned something about being more of a guide, more of a role model for a child.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess I don't know specifically, but that's just kind of what's going on.
I gotcha. Okay. I can give two suggestions that will give you a whole lot of mileage. a whole lot of mileage. One is that whenever you want to give some advice or give a suggestion, make it into a question, turn it around, and ask instead of telling. Just communicate with questions, because that does two things. First of all, you're showing respect for her, because you're actually interested in what she thinks, what she has to say, what she's feeling. And that is going to create an open environment where you're not coming as the adult, you're not coming as the parent or the surrogate parent in this case. You're not her biological mother, of course. However, you're clearly older than her and more knowledgeable in many ways, more experienced. But if you ask a question, right away you break down that barrier, that hierarchy, and she feels empowered because now you're not on the podium talking. You put her on the podium to talk, and she's just going to have a warm feeling inside.
Mm-hmm.
It happens automatically. It's just amazing. And secondly, you're going to empower her to bring out her best, because all of a sudden the ball is in her court, and she's going to want to, first of all, because she's a young person who has an ego and wants to feel grown up and feel responsible and show what she's made of, she's going to dig inside and she's going to pull up her best. You know, she might be struggling with a friend or something and you know, arguing with a friend and they're not getting along. So instead of you stepping in and saying, oh, I think you should do this and this and that, you could ask a question instead and maybe ask, well, you know, what do you think the trouble is between the two of you? What do you think is underneath it? And that will cause her to think and to reflect, to gain perspective on the situation rather than to just feel victimized or reactive, or maybe look for someone to rescue her. All of that is set aside all of a sudden, and now she's empowered. And now she's going to reflect, and she's going to be able to do something on her own. And then she might ask you in return, what do you think about that? What do you think about what I just said? Or what did you do when you were struggling with friends when you were a teenager? You know, you've got a dialogue going now.
Mm-hmm.
Than a parent-child relationship. And the second thing you can do is to tell stories. if she comes to you with the same question, you know, or you just observe it and you're just feeling sorry for her and you want to help, rather than saying, well, I see this and this and that happening, and if you don't mind, I'd like to give you a little advice here, tell a story instead. Maybe you remember a time when you were struggling with a friend. And stories create empathy, because right away, if she's struggling and you can say, oh, yeah, I know how, I can just imagine how you're feeling, how you're struggling here, because I remember when I was 13 years old in junior high and blah, 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 and tell your story. And that mm-hmm. does the same thing as asking questions. You're creating an opening and you're creating empathy. And then you will be able to come from a place of empathy rather than sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
Is that helpful?
Yes.
Great. Okay. Okay. Did you want to go anywhere else with that?
No. But I don't think I know how to mute myself again, or if that's needed. Do you know?
Yes.
What do I push?
Yes, I was just handed a note. Press *6.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
And I think the switchboard person here unmutes you.
Okay.
No. Okay, yeah, just press *6 if you want to mute or unmute. Is that correct?
Okay.
Okay, that's it. All right. Did you have anything else, Tess, or shall we move on to somebody else?
Nope, I think I'm done for now.
Okay. Does anyone else have something? A question? An answer? A story? I'd be glad to explore about anything, anything you have. Anything? Anybody?
Tamarack?
Yes.
Hello, it's Cindy White.
Cindy, hi.
Hi. Hey, I'm enjoying this conversation. Thank you for inviting me. And I have a question about what it means to be human. Hmm. Is it, I can't tell. What is good about the civilized world?
Wow. We're going to be here for a while with that question.
Well, let me zero in a little. You talk a little bit about symbiotic relationships.
Yeah.
You're talking a little bit about symbiotic relationships in your story with the caribou and the wolf and the indigenous cultures, and I was just thinking, to be human, obviously we want to evolve, and there's balance in that. And so is it possible, I mean, is there a symbiotic relationship between the civilized and the indigenous world, is I think what I'm asking.
Okay, yeah, that's a potent question. This relationship is the relationship between the civilized and the native world, the indigenous world, is really a construct, because there is no civilized world. Just like we can blast out into outer space and we think, wow, look what I did. Well, what goes up must come down. We cannot sustain ourselves there. And the civilized world as it exists is unsustainable. And And that has nothing to do with the Armageddon theories or anything like that. It has absolutely nothing to do with it. The real problem, it does not have to do with us running out of resources and global warming and all that sort of thing. Those are just symptoms. That's just a byproduct of what's going on, because every organism, every living creature modifies its environment for its own benefit. That is just the way life is. There's no problem with that. The problem is, as I see it, and this is just my perspective, of course, is that we have migrated from our hearts to our heads And this is why we are out of balance. And this is why we have created what appears to be a civilized world. We have separated ourselves from the means and ends of our existence. We are animals. Humans are animals. We are very intelligent animals, of course. That does not make us any different than any other animal or any other plant, though, because this tree right outside the window here is much taller than me. I cannot stand as tall as that tree. That tree has got it made over me. The wolves out in the wilderness just behind where I live are much faster runners than me, and on and on and on. Everybody has their own specialty, every one of our relations. So that makes them no better or no worse. It just makes them different, and this is part of the celebration of life. However, what we have done when we have gotten into our heads and separated ourselves from this beautiful relationship that has worked for all of eternity and not messed anything up, is that when we have gotten into our heads, we started to think, and thinking is a tool of the ego. And once the ego gets involved, all of a sudden we think we are something special, we're something superior. We've all of a sudden created a god, and we've become godlike, and we are evolving towards something. There's always something bigger and better out there. It doesn't matter whether it's a bigger and better car or a new spiritual paradigm or a new set of clothes or a bigger house. It's always bigger and better and bigger and better. We're always going somewhere, and we are not here. It's not be here now anymore. It's, oh, we've got this body that we've got to shed, and we're these beautiful spirits and blah, 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 blah. And there are thousands and thousands of theories and beliefs and premises as to how we ought to be, and we can no longer embrace who we are. And that's what's creating the terrible crisis in this world. We are destroying our bed. We're destroying our table. We're destroying our planet because we are not embracing who we are. So we've created this artificial construct. And creating this construct in and of itself, I don't see any problem with. A beaver builds a dam, and the dam creates a pond which floods out a section of forest and meadow. The trees die. There's tremendous doom and destruction behind a beaver dam. Animals get drowned out. They get pushed out of their habitats. The beaver pond warms up the water. Some of the fish die. However, at the same time, other fish are benefiting. The warm water fish move in. They proliferate. And the ducks come. And the water lilies and the water plants grow. And the moose come to eat on the water plants. And the frog population multiplies. And the muskrats move in. And the otters and the great blue herons. And the mink, and you see where I'm going with this, the only constant is change. And if we are changing within the context of the means and ends of our existence, it never goes out of balance because there are checks and balances there. The beaver can only create a dam so big because they're doing it with their own hands. And if we could do the same thing, if we can just re-become who we are, re-become human again, and do things with our own hands, with our own power, we will live in balance automatically. We won't have to do anything beyond that. Everything will be fine and beautiful again. We won't be killing each other. There won't be wars anymore. There won't be cities. We won't be paving over the planet. We won't be cutting down the forests mercilessly. We won't be driving our fellow species to extinction. There won't be any global warming. It will cease to exist. So that's my long story about the relationship between civilization and living natively in a nutshell. nutshell.
Thank you.
Do you have any comments or perspectives on that? I'd like to hear your perspectives as well.
So if the human has the brain, and that's, you know, one of our standout abilities, but we have, you know, we're too much in our head instead of our hearts, why were we given a brain? Why is that our standout feature?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I think this will help us get to the bottom of what we're talking about. It's a standout feature only because we are looking in a mirror. The brain is, we are looking rationally at who and how we are, and we're self-congratulatory. We're saying, oh, I have this brain. Boy, this is really great. However, we have a lot of wonderful features. We emphasize this brain because the ego and the intellect have this incestuous relationship, you might say, and both of them have taken over our being. We have a lot of beautiful features. We are the best runners on the planet, believe it or not. Did you know that we can run down horses?
No.
Yes. Nobody knows this. We can outrun a cheetah for distance. Cheetahs are fast, but they do not have the duration of a run that we do. Many native people, when the guardians are training, will use training for the hunt. They will use no weapons, no stealth, nothing. They will go and literally run down a gazelle or run down a deer or run down a horse. We can do it. We have that capacity. And I can go on and on about our tremendous abilities. It is not just our brain that distinguishes us, but we've lost touch with all of that. That's why we're not living in balance anymore. And that's why we have these big heads and these big egos, and we think we rule the universe.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. That's a great question, Cindy. Mm-hmm. Is there anywhere else you'd like to go with this?
No, this is great. Thank you so much.
Okay. Yeah, it's a beautiful topic to explore. There's so much there. There's just so much there.
Yeah, I know.
Is there anybody else who has a question? Any other thoughts? Any comments? Okay, I'll toss one in here. There's one that was asked before the teleconference started by some people who were here. And they were asking about cattails. Cattails, as many, if not all of you know, are a very good food source. They can be, they're there all the whole turn of the seasons. And at any time, as long as you're near a wetland with cattails, you have something to eat. In the white season, the tubers, if you can get down to them, and you often can because wetlands don't freeze very solidly, or if there's no snow, of course, you can get to them. The cattail tubers are high in starch. They can be eaten. And the little sprouts that are going to be the new growth when it warms up are edible. They're very nourishing. They have different nutrients in than the tubers themselves, actually. Some people will clean everything off except for the starch. And that's calories, of course, but it's pretty empty calories. The sprout is needed. The little bud is needed right along with the tuber in order to make it a more complete food. And then in the springtime, when they're starting to shoot up, sprout up, you can pick the young shoots just like asparagus and eat them that way. They can be eaten raw or cooked. It doesn't matter. And all the way through the growing season, the young leaves, the succulent leaves can be eaten. Even when the leaves get old, right at the base of the leaves, they're still on the tender side, and you can break the tops off and eat the base of the leaves. The stalk that's coming up with the cat tail, you know, the reproductive organ, is edible when it first comes up, and it's still green, you can boil it. Don't eat it raw. It's pretty hard to digest, but if you boil it or roast it, it's better boiled or, boiling or steaming. It can be eaten like corn on the cob. And then late in the green season, the top dies down and you go right back into the old cycle again. So there's always something to eat there. And wherever there is some shallow standing water, just about everywhere on the planet, actually, cattails grow in Eurasia, they grow in Africa, they grow all through North and North Central and South America. Except in the far north, you're not going to see cattails there, or very acid soils or very acid waters. They like a sweeter water. Anyway, what I'm getting to is that cattails are very easy to gather. Just about anybody can identify cattails. They don't run very fast, so you can catch them easy. They're just a really simple food to gather. So the people who are here were asking about whether we, in our wild food foraging instruction, if we teach about cattails. And I've gotten this question for decades because I do not teach about cattails. And the reason is that cattails are a no-brainer. They're there for everybody. A five-year-old can identify a cattail and go gather cattails to eat if need be. So if we become dependent upon such a simple and easy-to-gather food, when that food is not available, we're stuck. So I do it the reverse, actually. I take people out and I show them the uncommon foods. I show them what the potential is there in terms of what's possible to eat. There are hundreds of foods just within eyesight of where I'm sitting right now looking out the window. There are all kinds of foods available that people don't typically consider to be food. There are, 4 species of tree I'm seeing right now, and various grasses and all kinds of things outside, many of them under the snow yet here. But all of these things, and even things we can't see, things underground, that I like to go out and show people. I remember the one wild food gathering workshop I did. It was a weekend workshop, and we went out in a meadow and we sat down, and that's as far as we got. It was just, we were covering everything within reach. There was so much there, and not just the plant foods, but the animals who live on the plants, and on and on and on. Nobody wanted to go any further. They were just fascinated with what was right underfoot. And this is what our brains evolved for. This is the tremendous capacity we have to be in communion, to be in relationship with our plant and animal kin. And once we realize that this isn't just grass and these aren't just trees to shade us or for birds to build nests in, all of a sudden we evolve this kinship and we naturally live in honor and respect. And this is what the opening story was all about that I was telling, about not just having it be some belief or some spiritual paradigm, but this is real. Native people don't have any beliefs. They don't need them because they live it. There's no distinction between the spiritual and the physical. It's all one. And this is balance. So these people, I wasn't here when they asked the question, unfortunately, or I would have talked a little bit about what I'm sharing with you folks right now. And this is what I would like to encourage all of you to do. We have these beautiful, tremendous capacities. Let's use them to evolve relationship with each other, with our plant and animal kin, with the cosmos. Everything is relationship. Does anybody have any thoughts on that? Anybody have any more questions on that? I'd be glad to elaborate more. Or if you have any thoughts of your own you'd like to add, I'd like to hear them. I'm always learning. Anybody? Last chance. Just kidding. You'll have another chance. Okay, a question was just handed to me. Okay. The question I was just handed, the Family Wilderness Guide Program that we are, that the documentary is being made on right now, and that this fundraiser is all about, actually, to help fund the making of the documentary, it was an example of a different way of child rearing. What suggestions do you give parents living in society? That is a, wow, this question is a real opening, because we don't have to become hunter-gatherers again. We don't have to give up everything around us in order to raise our children in a way that is going to help them to be the people they're intended to be. There's a whole lot we can do on our own, a whole lot. And I'll throw out a couple of ideas right off the top. The most important thing I think we can do is to realize that what we have done is we have not only isolated ourselves from the earth, but we've isolated ourselves from each other. I just saw a statistic that 60% of the people in New York City live in their own apartments, one person per apartment. And that is really the antithesis of the way we are designed to live. We are the most highly evolved social creature. We are more social than wolves. We are more social than dolphins. We are more social than elephants. Many, if not most of our needs for sure, I don't know what percentage of our needs, I haven't seen any data, but most of our needs are best fulfilled, and some of our needs are fulfilled only through relationship, through our social contacts. Look at all of the things we do with other people when we really need something. Everything from needing a car or needing food, needing a pair of shoes, needing to get somewhere. It all involves other people in one way or another. There's very little that we can actually do on our own. And the first thing we can do and the first thing our children need is to have more than one or two role models on a regular basis, not just as teachers when they go to school or at daycare or having role models who live in the house next door, but they need to wake up with other people around them. They need to go to bed with other people around them. They need to have different storytellers in their lives. They need to have the example of other people when they're sitting down to eat. All of the life's regular activities need to involve other people, because children learn best by example. And when they only have one role model as the primary caretaker in their lives, which is usually mom, we have a lot of single-parent families, 40% of the children being born now are being born to single parents, I understand, in the United States. It's a tremendous amount of people. And two people is not enough, because that is only one male and one female. That is not enough examples for a child. A child needs to have a plethora of examples. What happens when a child runs into a conflict with mom? There's no other nurturer there. The child throws a tantrum. The child has a fit. The child runs away from home. Oftentimes it leads to a crisis, which is totally unnecessary. We're creating trauma for our children because we have isolated them from what they need, from the social context that they need to evolve in, because this is the way we're biologically programmed. It's imprinted in our DNA. It doesn't matter what I think or feel or believe. I cannot change my DNA. And why would I want to? People are beautiful. It's beautiful to be around other people. There's such a rich and essential sharing that goes on there that, yes, we can live alone or create the illusion of living alone. We can put up boundaries and protect ourselves from being hurt and all of that. What kind of life is that? Is this what we really want? Is this why we're really here? Let's see. Where else can we go with this question? What suggestions do you give parents living in society? That's my first suggestion. In whatever way possible, to get connected with other people. It could be creating a neighborhood groups. It could be sharing the raising of our children. If we have parents in the neighborhood who have children too, let's get together and do things together with our kids. It could be starting to share some of our resources. One thing that I realized when I was a kid, I would mow lawns for money. I would mow a couple of the neighbors' lawns, and I had a lawnmower. My family had a lawnmower, and I realized that, hey, this lawnmower is sitting 98% of the time. I mow the lawn once a week or every other week, and it just sits in the garage the rest of the time. I can put this lawnmower to use and go mow some other people's lawns and make some money for myself. And it felt so good to do that because I was helping other people. They were helping me. They were giving me some money so I could go buy a baseball mitt or whatever I wanted, candy bars. Don't tell anybody I used to eat candy bars. And it just felt so good. And look at our suburban lives. Everybody has their own lawnmower. It's totally unnecessary. There could be one lawnmower per block, and this lawnmower is just shared, and we help each other out. We share the maintenance of the lawnmower. Look at all the resources we would save, and look at the camaraderie we would be building by sharing. We're talking with our neighbors. We're helping to helping each other with lawn work when there's some heavy stuff to do or whatever. And this, in turn, is creating an example for our children. If the parents are getting together, the children are getting together. It's just naturally going to follow. And pretty soon we can transform our society just by opening up, sharing. So that's the short answer to the question. I'm writing a book on the topic, actually. There's so much that we can do. I'll go on. Just one more thing I'd like to suggest. I talked about the children's culture that naturally evolves when you bring a group of kids together, and that naturally exists with Native people. The same thing can happen in our urban environments if we allow our kids to get together. If we parents might take turns feeding the children in the neighborhood, for example. Let them get together for meals. Let them help prepare the meals. All of a sudden, a children's culture evolves. When I was a kid, I grew up in a small farming village, 800 people in the whole town, and we all knew each other. And the kids would get together and play. You know, we'd play games and sports, and we'd go over to each other's houses. If we were playing at somebody's house, mom would just invite all the kids in for lunch. You know, it was beautiful. Or it was a hot summer day, she'd bring out a big pitcher of Kool-Aid, and we'd all drink Kool-Aid together, and we just shared. Or she'd bring out a bunch of oranges for all of us to snack on when we were playing in the backyard. It was just such a beautiful sharing. And we had this children's culture that evolved, and we did things together. When one of us had an idea to do something, we'd go get all our buddies, and we'd go out and do it. And I have fond memories of my childhood. However, in metropolitan areas, children don't do that so much anymore. And of course, there are other distractions. Many children have their communities online now, you know, through computer games and such. There's still that yearning. You know, they want it. They want that culture. They want to be a part of that culture, the children's culture. Any thoughts on that? Does anybody else like to explore some aspect of that, or do you have a question on child rearing or what we might be able to do to help humanize child rearing?
Yeah, what you're talking about, how children nowadays have that culture, they tend to get it online. And I think my reaction is to somehow get the child, especially if they're glued to the TV or some playing video games. You can do that online with a lot of other kids now, too. And my reaction is almost, okay, how can I get her to go outside, you know, or do something else, because it's amazing how long she can sit there all day, 10 hours, you know, doing the playing video games or watching the TV. And, yeah, I guess for me it's do I say anything, or is that just the new thing that kids do to feel connected, or is there some other way I can get, make it? Because there's people in the house, you know, but the attention is given to people online she's communicating with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, boy. The question you asked is so vitally important, because right away what you asked here points to a lot of problems that are coming up with the upcoming generation. One of which is sexual abuse and sexual exploitation. We are visceral creatures. Because we are so highly socialized, we need touch in our lives. We need relationship, not just being with other people, but playing with other people and touching other people and hugging and doing things together. And when children are so isolated for so long, they become hungry for touch. And oftentimes, this is a setup for either teenage pregnancies or children getting involved in exploitative relationships with older people, with adults or even older children, just because they are craving touch. And they cannot put it into words, they cannot explain it, they don't understand it themselves, but there they are, they find themselves just being fulfilled in this insidious way, and it's very destructive to them. It's really a sad, sad situation. And I wish I had an answer. I wish I had an answer, and I just see with trends as they're going, I just see it getting worse and worse. Not because kids are being drawn to the screen, because what they're being drawn to, as we've already suggested, is just they're being drawn to community. It's perfectly natural and normal. This is what they have. We have isolated them. We've taken them away from the earth into urban areas and created environments where it is not only not very possible, but not very safe for them to just go out and run around the neighborhood and play with other kids. It's not very feasible for kids anymore. And what do parents do? We have soccer moms who are carting their kids around all the time to these various activities. You can't do it outside your door anymore. Kids are involved with one set of friends at school, another set of friends after school where they do something. Then they have another set of online friends, and they might have a couple of neighbors, neighborhood kids they hang out with sometimes too. It's impossible to really evolve a children's culture in the environment, in the fragmented environment that we have created for ourselves and that our kids are stuck with. Does that make sense, or can I explain that a little better?
No, that makes sense. Makes a lot of sense.
Okay. Yeah, I wish it didn't make as much sense. I wish there was another way around it, but that's just what I'm seeing, and it saddens me. I come almost to tears sometimes when I look around and I see what we're doing. And we think we're doing well, and in some respects we are, but sometimes we take one step forward and three steps back. It's just so sad. You know, there are many benefits to our modern means of communication. Computers have brought us a lot. I sit in front of a computer a lot when I'm writing. It's allowed me to be to do so much that I wouldn't be able to do on my own otherwise, to reach people. However, it has its dark side. Is there anything else? Any other thoughts, questions? Okay, well, maybe we'll wrap it up here. It looks like we've gone a bit over time anyway. This is a great sharing, folks. I could continue with this for a long, long time. There's so much that is so vitally important here, I think. You know, awareness is the first step in healing. I think it's the first step in re-becoming human. And that is human as we're designed to be, as we are created. I want to thank you all for being here, for listening, for your questions. And if ever there's any way that I can help, if I can be of service, just let me know. I'm here to serve. We all are. So don't hesitate. Don't be shy. Please just send me an email or call or any of us here at the school. We're all here to serve. And I think we're going to have another teleconference, same time, same station, next week, next Sunday afternoon. That would be at 2 o'clock Central Time, so you have to adjust the time, of course, as you did today. And this recording is going up on the website, I understand. So if you want to listen to this again or you want to take it off the website, you know, nothing's copyrighted or anything, if you want to share it with somebody else. Just go to www.teachingdrum.org and click on Media, and you'll have access to this. And thank you very much. I really appreciate your questions because there are really no answers. One question just leads to another and to another, and this helps me to get in touch with what's going on inside of me, too, and it helps me to realize how much better I can serve by bringing people what they need, what I have that I can offer, what the elders have given me and what I've learned. All right. Here's a hug to all of you, and I look forward to connecting again. I hope you can come back next week. I'd like to share more with you and hear more from you as well. Okay, here's a hug to you. So long for now.